You're listening to the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Red Shirts and Runabouts. I am Derek, your regular host, and I've got my two lovely friends who have been joining me on our Star Trek movie watch reviews. We did all four TNG era films together, finishing up last week, and now we move on to the Kelvin timeline. I have Ray.
Hello.
And Zach.
How's it going?
Good to be back, guys. Good to have you with me still. And we are going to talk a little bit about news. We've got some Trek news before we dive into Star Trek 2009. So, of course, if you haven't had an opportunity to see the 9-year-old film yet, spoiler alerts, because we'll be talking all about it.
It makes me feel old. It's 9 years old.
9 years.
How much brighter was the world 9 years ago?
Much. all right. So we're going to kick things off with some really kind of interesting real estate news, I guess, if you want to own a piece of Star Trek history. Zach, do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah. So Next Generation, Season 3, Episode 3, there's a little episode called The Survivors, where the crew basically beams down to a planet colony, and the only surviving people is this, like, is this aging couple, basically. And they've got a pretty sweet house. And if you want to buy that house, and you have, what was it, like, almost $6 million? Yeah.
5.695.
Yep, yep. So if you've got some extra change and you want this little-known piece of Trek history, I mean, it's a cool-looking house. The interior tour looked pretty cool. And it was a fun episode. I don't have the money, and if I did, I don't know that I, you know, love that episode enough to buy the house. But, I mean, you know, if I was moving to wherever it is, California anyways, then yeah.
Yeah, it's in central Malibu, Santa Monica, Unified School District. Four-bedroom, four-bath.
Yeah.
Not too bad. It's on 2 acres. So.
I mean, the land is appealing. And the appliances look like they've been updated since the 90s, or late, I guess it would have been early 90s when that season aired. So, you know, that's a good thing.
Ooh, bamboo flooring.
I was just looking at that, yeah. Yeah.
That's nice.
And I do like the circular window, like the portal window. Like that, I feel like that was probably in a shot or two in the episode. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but that's featured in some of these photos. It's got a very Trek look to it.
Yeah, some of the details in this are pretty funny, though. Like, room for pool and horses.
Why is it William Shatner bought it?
So, yeah, I guess it's out there. It's for sale. It's been on the market a little over a month, so you better get moving, people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say about that.
It isn't too often that, like, something that was actually on Star Trek is for sale, so that's kind of a fun,
yeah,
fun little thing. All right, so the big news, of course, this week is the announcement of a new Star Trek series.
Mm-hmm.
This is a half-hour animated comedy.
Yes.
From one of the head writers of Rick and Morty, where it's going to be titled Star Trek Lower Decks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got 2 seasons. CBS All Access has greenlit it for 2 seasons. Not sure how many episodes are in each season yet. I don't think we saw that necessarily.
I'd imagine 10 at the most for the season one, at least.
You think?
10 to 13, maybe.
I mean, that's still low for an animated
show. I mean, especially, I'm going off of, like, Rick and Morty numbers, basically.
That's fair.
One would assume.
Yeah, it, so yeah, so Mike McMahon? I don't know. McMahon.
McMahon.
It is McMahon, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I got caught up on the 2 M's.
It's a lot of M's. More M's than a bag of M&M's.
He it's his show. He's kind of the showrunner, creator of it. And he also wrote the one of the Star Trek short treks that are coming up, the one that has to do with Mud. So,
I did not know that.
Yeah, so that will be our first introduction to his trek. So Lower Decks, basically it's going to focus on a lesser known, less significant starship.
Sure.
And the characters, or not the characters, but the crew members who have the more day-to-day normal duties, maybe some of the menial tasks, you know, the ones who are actually scrubbing the, what is it, the, what do they have them scrub all the time? They always threaten to have people scrub stuff.
Yeah. The stuff that needs scrubbing.
I'm drawing a blank on all the manifolds, scrubbing manifolds or whatever. That type of stuff, refilling the replicators, you know.
Right.
Maybe mopping the cargo decks. That sort of thing.
And I mean, and the premise itself is very guarded from the rest of canon, so they basically have free reign to do whatever they want. I assume dick jokes included.
I mean, I guess on CBS All Access, they'll have some flexibility on that. People are unsure about it, so I did do a poll, but Ray, what do you think about this series? Do you have any initial thoughts?
Give it a chance. I absolutely love animation. I don't know if this is, like, if this ends up being for adults, then it's kind of more Orville style with, you know, jokes of the mature nature, or if it's more, you know, Avatar or Dragon Prince or something based for all ages, I'm probably still going to enjoy it. There's very few things Star Trek that I do not enjoy, so, you know, I'll watch the first few episodes at the very least and either stick it out for the full first season or, you know, just kind of reprioritize and watch the Picard show instead.
Yeah. That's fair. That's fair. Speaking of the Picard show, this actually Lower Decks will probably air before the Picard show.
Most likely. Yeah.
Lower production value or cost, at least. No, you know, value, but cost.
Well, there's no building sets, you know, and
it takes a lot longer to animate than it does to act. But if they're able to just start it immediately instead of do a ton of prep work, then that may save time. They could air like almost simultaneously, you know, just because there's more front end work on one and more back end work on the other.
Hey, well, I know their plan is not to double up shows anytime in the foreseeable future. So one's going to go first.
So Discovery may air. Discovery's airing in the early or late winter, early spring. And then Lower Decks could be summer, and then Picard show in the fall. Like,
I feel like that would be really quick. I would more expect.
I mean, more time. I just meant like that.
It's possible.
That's the idea. Yeah. Absolutely. The idea is to have always something Trek to watch on CBS All Access and not doubling up. So that way, you know, to give people a reason to subscribe all year round.
Right. I mean, that's what it's going to take to get me. And I think they know that after the numbers dipped so much post-Discovery Season 1.
Mm-hmm. Now, I did a poll on Twitter under Red Shirts Pod, and 61% of people are excited. They're looking forward, quote, looking forward to the Lower Decks animated show. About 25% said that it was too early to tell, and then 8% were 50-50, with just 6% saying no, which was kind of pleasantly surprising that the majority of people either were really excited about it or, you know, were just kind of not sure yet, because there's not a lot of information. So,
well, last week we talked very briefly about Trek branching out into other genres, and like I mentioned, Trek horror would be fun, but we didn't talk about Trek animation or Trek comedy. So, you know,
my idea was a low budget pitch of like, you know, Adult Swim style, but this is better than what I was wanting. But
no, I think it's a good plan. I'm always nervous because of how serious and heavily focused on society and pushing it forward, progressing that Trek has. You know, like, they have to do this without ruining the stuff they've already set up, without making fun of it. So I hope they really focus on the tropes that do make this fun, that do make this corny, like the red shirt trope and things like that, as opposed to taking away from what all the other shows have built.
Yeah. Now here's a question for you guys. Because it's animated, they have a little more flexibility for when the show can take place, right? We kind of talked about this last week too, about how I was expecting them, you know, to do a TNG animated show because you could bring back all the actors. When would you want Lower Decks to take place?
Because
I don't believe we know the when yet.
I just off the top of my head, I think maybe in the Kelvin timeline, because I'd like to see something where it's briefly mentioned about Chekhov. Like, I don't know how they can handle Anton Yelchin's death other than just not doing any more Kelvin films. Like, that's it. You're just done.
Well, so CBS, I don't think, can do Kelvin stuff.
Interesting, because Paramount owns it.
Right,
yeah.
I heard about that.
Okay.
And I'm not sure. I know they can't make movies, so I'm not sure if they can do Kelvin stuff or not.
That's fair. And maybe towards, like, the TNG Voyager era, where there's just a ton of ships to choose from and a ton of different options.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Zach?
I mean, I like the idea of it being kind of rough and tumble. And, I mean, getting to show the rough edges of the Enterprise. I mean, hopefully with some, you know, inappropriate adult jokes. And I feel like that might fit in more with between, like, Enterprise and original series. But for the reason Rachel just mentioned, I would like to see it later because there's more species, there's more ships, a little bit more flexibility.
You can have cameos. Everybody could come on to do voice work here and there.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I mean, they could do it post-Nemesis prior to the Picard series.
Yeah.
Right? There's 30 years, give or take, between there that you could do. And then, yeah, you could. I mean, you could have it take place on the Challenger with, you know, Captain LaForge
or something
like that.
Or if you do it earlier, you can do it before any of these characters are killed off. Tasha, Jadzia, you know, you can.
Yeah, I mean, they did say it was going to take place on a lesser-known vessel.
Right.
So
that doesn't mean cameos can't occur. They can't run into people on shore leave or something like that. I don't want them to be full cast members.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to really broaden your horizon, do it. But you have people still out there working. Sure. You can lean on that.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I think if they did something on the Titan or the Challenger, you could have some fun with that because since they're the lower decks people, they don't see the captain on a regular basis.
Right.
Right? So you could have, you know, Geordi or Riker show up like maybe two or three times for a scene, right? Because these are the lower decks people. They're not bridge officers.
Right.
Right.
Right. And so that could be kind of a fun way to connect to existing ships.
Yeah.
Right.
I actually hope that it's just like, call it like a college dorm and everybody's like sleeping with everybody and, yeah, you know,
like. Well, I kind of thought that they would do like an academy. I guess there was rumored for a while maybe doing a teen drama, you know, taking place at the academy, but the academy would also be a great setting for an animated adult humor show.
So speaking of that, to kind of segue a little bit here, so in addition to Lower Decks, CBS has filed trademarks for some other show name possibilities. They've registered names for Star Trek Revolution, Star Trek Starfleet Academy.
Star Trek XNR.
Not quite.
Too soon.
Not quite. Star Trek SETI Alpha 5.
Oh. Oh, okay.
Star Trek Reliant and Star Trek Destiny.
Okay.
And there's a couple of these I specifically want to talk about.
Yeah.
So, SETI Alpha 5, for those who don't know, that is the planet that Khan was...
This is SETI Alpha 5.
Right. That's
going to be the opening theme song.
Kirk marooned Khan on SETI Alpha 5. And there have been all of these rumors and murmurings of Nicholas Meyer doing his own Star Trek show in secrecy, which is why he's just a consultant on Discovery. And what is he probably most well known for?
Wrath of Khan.
So that would be if I was going to put money on
that.
They're
going to do a Wrath of Khan show.
But do you think he'd want to go back to that either?
I mean, he knows he saved the franchise from the graveyard.
Absolutely.
With the Khan character. And I think that it could be interesting if he wanted to portray what his people went through on that planet.
I mean, it's just going to be Star Trek Lost or Star Trek Gilligan's Island. Like, I don't care to see that.
Yeah.
That one's not one for me.
Okay.
If that's the
I'll watch
idea.
It.
Well, of course you will. You guys are Star Trek lords.
I'll watch it. It does seem like an unnecessary prequel.
Some of these are self-explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
Starfleet Academy.
Yeah.
No idea what that's
probably about.
That's going to be Academy really easy because I can film that on site in San Francisco.
I mean, more or less.
Yeah.
The main character, they need to get what's his name back, the gardener.
Oh, Boothby?
Boothby. Assuming that actor is still with us, he needs to be on the show. He's probably not there.
Fairly old in the 90s.
Recast Boothby.
If that happens, then I want Wheaton to come back. He's had all this time with the Traveler, and now he's a professor at the Academy.
Professor Wheaton.
Well, and you could bring Barkley back. Right? Barkley could definitely be at the Academy. And we had talked a little bit about this with the Picard show.
Barkley and Wesley Crusher.
If you wanted to, you could have them take place in the same time period and have some characters cross between the two, like a Barkley character.
Sure.
I'm all for that.
Now, if I had to guess, Which one of these was the Picard show?
It'd be Destiny.
Destiny?
What Destiny, Revolution, was there a Legacy in there?
Revolution and Reliant.
Reliant, okay. Yeah. What I mean, Reliant, like, Reliant makes me hope, like, it's the Worf show. I know it's not, but...
Is that because it rhymes with Defiant?
That's the thing. So for right. a Reliant show, the only ship we really know called Reliant is the one from The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Is there another story to tell with that ship? It's a Miranda-class science vessel. It didn't really seem to be of any significance.
It's David's, you know, growing up. It's a prequel to David.
Oh, boy. That's what we need.
Little baby David.
Little baby David.
Not Carol Marcus show, which would be very interesting, but David, you know, because yes. that's how things work out for me in my timeline.
We need more white males represented in Star Trek, if you ask me.
Although, now that I'm thinking about it, a Carol Marcus show would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. That would be pretty cool. I don't know that you could call it Reliant, because the Reliant was only used...
I think it'd be better... called Star Trek Genesis.
Yeah.
Genesis?
Wow, that just happened.
You have to. It's a podcast thing. If somebody says it, you have to.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't even know that rule.
Yeah, so keep that in mind for future.
I will never say it again.
Say what?
Nothing.
What was the first book in the Bible? Can someone remind me? What was that?
I'm going to pistol whip the next person who says shenanigans.
So I agree with you, though, Ray. I think Destiny is the name of the Picard show.
Yeah.
I do. It's the only one on the list that I think makes any sense, and I think calling it Star Trek Picard...
Yeah.
Star Trek Picard!
It just doesn't quite work
for me. Doesn't flow.
And I think Destiny could be really good, because it's something that's been used in Trek. There's the Best Destiny concept, and there's the Star Trek Destiny books.
Well, there's the whole concept of Manifest Destiny. Mm-hmm. It was always an explorer, you know... creating his own destiny. So, I mean, just going off of that alone makes me want that to be the Picard show.
For sure.
Fair enough. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. I'm smart.
Any other thoughts on any of the show stuff before we move on?
I wonder, I mean, Revolution, like, that, I mean, that's a fairly overused term in, you know, naming of sci-fi or whatever shows. But, like, I mean, what I don't know what that would be focused on. And I almost wonder, and I'm asking this from the stance of I'm a Doctor Who fan. I just watched the most recent episode last week, and there are some very, very obvious call-outs of our current political regime. And it's fascinating. And it's like, okay, like, this is cool, and it wasn't heavy-handed, and I appreciate when sci-fi speaks truth to power, because that's something that Star Trek has always done it from the beginning. They were a little bit more... tongue-in-cheek to get away with it from the censors, but I don't know. To call it Revolution and to try and be a revolutionary show seems a little cheesy, but I do wonder, as we look forward to these, increased rollout of shows, of Star Trek shows, like, I wonder how Trek is going to continue to be socially active and the commentary that we're going to see in the kind of messy times that we're in.
Well, I will say, for Revolution, I think a cool spot to look at would be the Cardassian Empire post the Dominion War.
Right.
Because, you know, the Obsidian Order is not in a great spot. The Cardassian military is more or less destroyed. Mm-hmm. Cardassia Prime is not in a good economic position or anything like that. That would be a prime opportunity for a revolution in one of the major powers.
Absolutely.
So I think that could be really interesting.
That would be cool to see.
Yeah, I was thinking it would be something similar to that, or even like a, depending on how long they want these TV shows to run, they can even show a lot of the Cardassian occupation of Bajor.
That's an interesting point.
Because like that was an actual revolution.
They could show that it ends in the beginning of Deep Space Nine. That's a cool idea too. I like that quite a bit.
Because, I mean, that happened for, you know, like, I don't know. It was a long time that they occupied Bajor. So, you know, it could be that.
I like that.
We could see a young Kira, like a child.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
So. Yeah.
Cool.
I like that.
I don't know. Like, I feel like the shows keep focusing on the various wars. Well, you're kind of running out of the canon wars. You're talking about a lot. Are you going to make up some weird ones? Like all of a sudden there was a Federation Ferengi war that we don't know about? Or So I think exploring the stuff that they do have is a better option, or going far into the future and creating new stuff.
Right. And the short that comes out next week actually apparently jumps ahead 1,000 years after Discovery, cool. Which puts it actually a little bit farther ahead than any future time we've ever seen on Star Trek. Voyager got close, but short of like 50 years or something like that, maybe 100 years. And so that'll be kind of interesting to see. Maybe that's one of these shows. You know, maybe Destiny is the future show or something like that.
That would be cool.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break and then we're going to come back and discuss Star Trek 2009.
Hey there, I'm Batman. And I wanted to tell you about my friends at the Screen Heroes Podcast. They deliver sweet justice in the form of discussing movies, television, and me. They love my movies. Every single one of them. Yes, even that one. Sometimes they even have me on as a guest, which is thrilling. You can find them at twitch.tv/heroespodcasts. Live on Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Gotham time. If you can't tune in live, the new shows go up on places like Spreaker, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Gotham Radio, Themyscira Live, and Blog Talk Radio. Now, back to your regularly scheduled Batcast.
All right, and we are back. So, we are going to be discussing Star Trek 2009. This is your last spoiler warning for that. We have been reviewing the Star Trek movies, and so we've decided to move on to the Kelvin films. Star Trek 2009 was kind of a big deal. Star Trek had been dead for a few years. Nemesis, of course, was the last movie, and Enterprise was no longer on the air after 2004. They tore down the Star Trek Experience in Las Vegas around the time that this movie came out, and it was marketed basically as a reboot. New casts, new time period, bringing us all the way back to actually prior to the original series. And I was kind of thinking we could start with what our initial thoughts were when we found out about the movie, whether it was a trailer, the first poster, whatever that may be, how you guys were feeling about this movie way back in 2007, 2008.
So this is what got me into Star Trek. Believe it or not, it did happen before I met Derek. But,
dun, dun, dun.
You but, existed prior to that moment? Oh. Like...
Good night, guys. This has been fun.
She just burst out of the earth, fully grown. God.
Derek made a wish, and I sprouted.
That's what I've been doing wrong in my dating life all these years.
He built me in a laboratory. It's weird all science right, to me. All right. Anyway, so this got me into it. I was a Heroes fan, so I loved Zachary Quinto. I loved Chris Pine. At the time, he was rumored to play Green Lantern, so
right.
I loved right. that idea. I was following Zoe Saldana's career. I was a huge fan of Harold and Kumar, so I loved John Cho. Like, everybody that was cast, I was a fan of, so I was like, I'm going to like this movie, I bet. And you know, still to this day, I think it's probably one of the most spot-on castings I've ever seen reboots or remakes do. Like, everything about it was perfect, and every single cast member is just on point. And they have really good chemistry together. So I knew yeah. from the trailer that I was going to enjoy what was put on the screen. And I did, and I've been kind of a Trekkie since then.
Yeah. Initial thoughts. I was into Trek before this, but more casually. I went to college, and that's when I got into the original series, binged all of that, really fell in love with it. And so that was my main experience with Trek, both growing up, my mom watching it, my mom like introducing me to some of the movies, and then watching the original series in college. And so when this, you know, they announced this, it was very... it was very exciting for me because this is the cast that I was most interested in. So I was excited. It looked like a fun action film. I didn't begrudge it that at all. But yeah, I was excited. I, like Rachel, I was also a Heroes fan. So That was fun. Weird to see Quinto in that role because I only saw him as Siler, but now I kind of forget that Heroes existed until people mention it, and I'm happier that way.
Yes.
But Quinto is one of the gems that came out of that unscathed, and his contribution as Spock was fantastic, so...
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you guys there. So obviously, you know, I've been a Trekkie my whole life. And so the idea of a new Star Trek was just incredibly exciting. I still remember seeing the initial teaser for the first time. And I don't know if you guys remember it or not, but the original teaser was just pieces of the Enterprise still being built with some voiceovers in the background and like construction work going on and Leonard Nimoy's voice coming in at the end, and it was just, like, super cool. It was super well done. It felt Trek at the time. The poster, the Warp Speed poster that's all in black and white, I still have it. It's one of my favorite movie posters, if not my favorite Star Trek movie poster, maybe second only to Beyond's.
Yeah.
And so I was just really excited to see this movie actually happen. I was a big Quinto fan from the first season of Heroes as well, you know, so another excuse to see him was really cool, and I thought the casting was solid for him. You know, the only other person I really knew at the time, thinking back on it, was probably James Cho from the Harold and Kumar movies. That's really all I think I knew. I recognized Bruce Greenwood, but I couldn't really place him at the time. I knew Eric Bana from The Hulk, I guess.
Oh, God.
Right? You know, so it was, you know, not the biggest, you know, A-list cast or anything like that, which was kind of nice. So I was looking forward to it. I was excited, maybe a little disappointed that they weren't continuing forward in time. But at least it was same. Forward from Enterprise, so it's a step in the right direction. But all right, so let's jump into the movie and begin, you know, with one of the greatest openings in sci-fi, in my opinion, anyway. The first 10 to 12 minutes of Star Trek 2009.
There was not a dry eye in the theater.
That scene is so cool.
It is.
The Kelvin is a beautiful ship. I actually love that design quite a bit. I think that scene is really well done.
It is.
Chris Hemsworth, you know, might have made a really good Kirk. Captain Kirk. Jim Kirk, that is, actually, given the opportunity.
Yeah.
There were some weird choices up for that role, and I'm glad they went with Pine, though. But that was Hemsworth's, like, film debut.
Yeah.
He got Thor right after.
And he was great. I mean, he's super believable. It's really well acted, that scene, and it's still...
I mean, he has an American accent in the movie. You would have never known that he's Australian.
It throws me a little bit now that I know him so well as Thor. I expect him to sound like Thor, you know.
Which is a British accent.
Which is not his normal accent either, right? And so, like, he's got three different voices for me, and the Thor one is just ingrained in my head now.
Yeah.
It's a really cool scene. I like the Kelvin ship because it is a step backwards. We haven't really seen a ship from that time period. So you can tell that it predates the Enterprise a little bit. You know, it's got phasers that actually pop up as like little disruptor cannons. And
yeah,
it's got the one nacelle.
It was a cool fight scene.
It's a really well done scene. I have some consistency issues with it when you compare it to one that happens later in the movie.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. So
they blew their budget wad on that opening scene.
I mean from a storytelling perspective, actually.
Oh, okay.
It is a really beautiful scene, though.
Yes.
Right? The CGI is wonderful in that opening scene. And it's just acted well across the board. I love the uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of a nice bridge between the Enterprise uniforms and actually what we end up seeing in Discovery.
Oh, yeah.
With the blue.
It's true.
I thought that was really nice.
So, fun fact, everybody on that ship...
is dead.
Only receives the script for that scene. They did not see the rest of the script because it was so safeguarded.
Hmm.
All the prime actors, the main cast, they read their scripts under security guard detail.
Oh, geez.
That sounds like Abrams.
He's well-versed at keeping secrets that he doesn't even have.
Look, guys, it's not going to be Khan, okay? So just stop thinking it is.
He didn't write the scene that it was Khan until like the day before. He dispersed the scripts.
It's like, fine, it's Khan.
Fine, it's Khan.
I don't think have anything any better. Other ideas.
I was just stalling. Look, this worked on Lost. I could stall year after year and wait for the ideas to come and then just wrap it all up at the end.
There's some really cool moments, though. There's the woman who gets sucked out into space, you know, and it's just dead silence.
God.
Yeah.
So directors are always very afraid to use moments of silence, and I feel that Abrams took a risk right there because, you know, nothing is ever silent. We hear ambient noise or background music or score or something, but, you know, he did it, and I kind of praise directors when they go that full force into the silence, because that can be almost as jarring as like a loud noise.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the Force Awakens scene when you were talking.
Well, when you think about this scene, the Kelvin battle, I mean, this is a loud scene. The music is loud. The explosions are loud. There's, you know, red
Hemsworth
alert siren
and
going off.
And are yelling at each other over the comm.
You know, it is an intense collection of scenes, and then nothing.
Mm-hmm. Which was especially jarring in the sense that you got this action scene, but the overarching, I guess, theme of the scene is that human life has value. And that silent scene is when that woman gets sucked out. And so it's not like this is just like an action movie where shit's blowing up left and right. It's like, oh, someone died and we should pause to acknowledge that's a big deal. Because someone else is about to die here in a minute and that's going to be an even bigger deal.
And it does acknowledge something that sci-fi gets knocked for from time to time. And if you think about it for more than 30 seconds, it doesn't really work. But it's, there's no noise really in space, so the laser blasts and stuff aren't going to make any noises. And yeah, but I think that would be really boring if every fight scene was like that.
Right.
Right? So this gives us an opportunity to see what it would have actually sounded like, right? But not make for an entirely boring action film.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? So,
for sure.
Technically,
if you're on
like
your
it.
Ship, those lasers do have noises because they're making impacts and stuff like that. It's only when you are floating in space do they not have noise? So,
sure.
You know, that's the nitpicky. You want to nitpick, I can nitpick too. So.
Right. But like, you know, like towards the end of the movie, you know, the Enterprise is firing torpedoes and it has that super cool kind of like boomerang sound to them, right? And it's an amazing sound. It's one of my favorite sound effect noises. But you wouldn't hear that.
Yeah.
Right? Well, that doesn't make for a fun scene, does it?
Right.
So the Kelvin scene is super cool. He does save the day in a pretty heroic way, which, you know, is neat because we don't get to learn much about Kirk's father in the rest of canon Trek. So to know that that's the kind of person he is says a lot about, you know, where Jim came from, right? Which is pretty cool. And I love the Tiberius joke.
Yeah.
You know, when they're going to name him.
I respect that he didn't want that to happen. But in all honesty, Jim George sounds pretty awful too.
Which is why it works. I mean, it's cute and it's nice to hear that's where the name came from, you know?
Well, if I knew that I'm going into my final moments, you know, trying to keep a lighthearted feel would mean a lot to me. You know, if I knew I'm going to miss the birth of my child and I'm never going to meet my child, I'm never going to see my wife's face again, you know, being as loving and playful as possible would probably be at the forefront of my mind. Because what she's going through is way worse than what I'm going through.
That's fair. That's fair.
I agree.
Anything else about this scene, I guess, before we move on to other things?
Three actors from Marvel in the first, like, 30 seconds. just saying.
Same universe.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. It is. I can appreciate that. Now, I mean, I guess Banna wasn't MCU, but still Marvel. Marvel. So, you know.
I have a consistency issue that I'll bring up in a bit, too. But it has to do with the Romulans.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah.
Cool. Very cool. One tiny detail that I think is easily missed is on the Kelvin, they're communicating with the engine room, and the guy's actually talking to a flip communicator. And it does look exactly like an original series style communicator. And I liked that. This far back, maybe the inner ship communication system is not quite advanced enough for them to just be able to talk into nothing like they do later in the movie.
Right. Right. Yeah. Details, man, details.
So I like that. I thought that was a nice little touch that they would keep these around, kind of like we do today. Like, remember when the Nextel push to talk thing was really big for like construction workers and that type of stuff, right? Like, I like that was still a thing.
He did a great job at putting in nods to everything. There's obvious nods like the, you know, all I have left is my bones. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. And then there's small ones like Majel got to record for the computer 2 weeks before her death. She finished her line. So, you know, he hired her on. And there's just a lot of fan service that I'm not quite sure you notice on the first watch.
Yeah, the Barrett thing is a big deal because this was, you know, being her last opportunity to voice in Star Trek meant that it was after that, Into Darkness was the first Star Trek canon piece that she was not involved in. Mm-hmm. Which when you think about how much time from 64, since she was in the original pilot, right, through 2008.
Yeah.
Because that's when she recorded her lines was in 2008. You know, so 2009 is when the movie came out, like she was involved. And that's pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, their son, Rod, Nichelle Nichols, Walter Koenig, George Takei, William Shatner, and Steven Spielberg were the first people to see the final film. So, I did not know that. You know, people want to harp on Abrams for not being a Star Trek fan prior to this, but he did his research and he had so much respect for what came before him. Like, he let Nimoy do his own thing. He didn't direct him. He's like, this guy knows more about Trek than I ever will. So... Right.
So basically, he was the exact opposite of Nemesis director that we talked about last week.
And, like, Nichelle Nichols was offered the role of Uhura's grandmother, but she couldn't because she fell ill. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Instead, Zoe Saldana spent a weekend at her house just getting to know her. And
that's cool.
The original crew was very involved. Yeah. I mean, George Takei kind of talked James Cho into taking John the role. Cho. Why do I keep saying James Cho?
James T. Kirk. You're just confusing John the Cho. Names I have here.
I apologize. That's Jason Lynn.
Jason Lynn. Yeah, you're right. I'm just screwing up all of the J names.
Anyway, John Cho. He had talked to John Cho because John was
he's
hesitant
Chinese
to take the role.
And not Japanese. He's Korean.
Yeah. John Cho's Korean and the Sulu character is Japanese because George Takei is Japanese. And George Takei's stance was basically that Sulu represents all of Asia.
Yeah.
Right? Not just the Japanese. The point in the 60s was to be a reflection on World War II, and that's why Japanese was important, but that's not the point anymore. The point today is that it's for the Asian cultures. They're still represented in some way, right? That's why Chekhov was a big deal, the Cold War against Russia, right? Like those those nationalities were very specific in the 60s.
Yes.
And we just, you know, they're still important today, of course.
And Yelchin was hired on because of his lineage. It was so close to Koenig. He comes from Russian Jewish parents. And that was really important to Abrams. Now, I don't know how many, you know, Russian Jewish lineage actors there are out there. I'm sure it's way more than what I have in my head. But Yelchin already had, like, a decent career under his belt, too. So, you know, that helped as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all right, so let's move on. So we have the Kirk and Spock as children scene, which
both fun.
They're fun scenes. You know, the Corvette scene is a lot of fun for me.
Greg Grunberg voices the stepdad over the phone, and Grunberg was supposed to have a full role. He's had a full role in every Abrams project, but he couldn't due to his Heroes role at the time. So
I have to look up who that even is, because I don't remember.
He's in Beyond. He's the guy who kind of runs the control center at the space station at the York Tower.
Oh, yeah.
He's in Force Awakens. Yeah. He's in Super 8. Like, he's in every Abrams film. Like, they're just friends. So
he was one of the leads in Heroes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the network wasn't super excited about having two of their leads unavailable. I think that the casting for young Spock was really good. It's kind of a cool scene, and I like the way the scene plays out. First off, it looks like Vulcan to me, right? It's very reminiscent of something in the animated series when you see young Spock in school. It's pulled straight out of there, and when Spock goes off on him and just beats the shit out of that kid, I mean, there is not really any part of me that does not enjoy that. So
yeah, I love that. Also, oh sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, I know they're not kids in this, but I do love that, like, the evolution of him through his time, and then that scene where he's like, live long and prosper. And it's like, I mean, it was like the fuck you way to say that phrase that is usually seen as very peaceful.
Well, so that's, so I got to see the movie opening night, full IMAX theater. Like, nice. This was max to the brim. And
I saw it 2 weeks earlier.
Oh, shit.
Good for you. Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing you didn't know each other at that time, or he would not have been okay with it.
I wasn't seeing pre-screenings back then. But anyway, when that scene happens, though, when Spock gives the live long and prosper, the whole theater just goes, oh!
Yeah.
And it was just great, because, like, you know, you don't get too many, like, whole theater reactions that are exactly right. The same. And so that was just a really fun, that was a fun moment.
Yeah.
One of the best parts of opening night films, I don't get this experience as often anymore, but, like, opening night, like, you get those, like, boisterous reactions from the entire theater, which is cool.
Okay, were you going somewhere with that, Ray?
Well, I also like that being Terran, or Earth, whatever you want to call it, and his mother are the parts of him that elicit the most emotion. You know, he cares more deeply for her because, you know, you can tell that his dad has always been a little standoffish. And
it's called Vulcan.
Exactly. So that's what I'm going to call you from now on.
It's Vulcan. Hurtful. It's
hurtful. Why don't you like the Vulcans, Derek?
Moving on.
Contrary to what he wants people to believe, Derek is very warm and romantic and cuddly, so... Okay. That's nice. Anyway.
It's a lovely tangent.
Yes, it is.
Do I need to leave while you guys work this out?
No, it's perfect. So, I like that, you know, the kids are able to elicit an emotion, that Kirk's able to elicit an emotion, that, you know, even the Vulcan High Council, the Science Academy, is able to elicit at least a, well, now I'm not going to your stupid school, so you can fuck off. Like,
yeah.
So that means a lot to me, and I actually wanted them to kind of continue that, like, not show any anger. You can mention his mother with showing other emotions, but clearly his mother means a lot to him, and I don't think he needs to lose that. I actually think he should keep it.
And I think he does.
Yeah.
This is a more emotional Spock.
For sure.
Than we're used to seeing in Star Trek, at least, you know, early on. Spock lightened up as he got older, actually. Right. You know, so we're kind of seeing the opposite of that here, which is interesting. So then, of course, we get Kirk in the bar fight.
Yes.
That's pretty Kirk. I mean, it actually reminded me a little bit of Picard from Tapestry.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just a little bit. I mean, it's a fine scene. I don't really have much of a problem with it.
Yeah.
Bruce Greenwood's introduction's pretty solid, though, as Captain Pike. I think that's just wonderful casting.
We meet Cupcake for the first time.
Oh, right. Who has a much bigger role in the comic books,
he does,
by the way.
Rewatch that. That's one of my takeaways of rewatching this, is it made me want to go back and read all the comics, because the Mike Johnson run was very good.
Mm-hmm. It's a fun scene. I like that Kirk and Uhura are talking to each other across this other alien who clearly just wants to be left alone to their drink.
Uhura, that was a name I was going to make up for you.
The only thing I wish they would have omitted was when he, like, in the fight choreography, and he grabbed Uhura's breasts. Like, I thought you could have done that. Like, you could have just had him bump into her and she could have, like, punched him or shoved him instead. You didn't have to have that. That was unnecessary. You're like, they already added in way more sex appeal than any other Star Trek has had before, unless you count naked fan dance.
Yeah, that's a fair point, because I did not remember how much they sexualized Uhura in the 2009 film.
Yeah,
I had forgotten that, because it was
not important, so you block it.
Well, yeah, it was not important, and it's not in Beyond, and it was so blatant with Marcus in Into Darkness. I just kind of forgot about the 09 one. And so, like, that actually kind of caught me off guard. Like, you know, the scene in her room, right, with the Orion and all that kind of stuff. Like, I actually totally forgotten that she gets undressed in that scene.
I don't know. It's kind of more natural for me in that scene. I had female roommates where we got undressed in front of each other and didn't think anything of it. We just had normal conversations. But the boob thing and the bar fight seemed unnecessary. I guess man service. It's not fan service, it's yeah. man service.
Yeah.
Because he had already pissed off Uhura. She was just trying to order drinks and he's all up in her business. Like, there wasn't much that needed to happen for her to shove him.
I agree with you. And, I mean, the movie does make Kirk out to be, like, this crazed ladies' man kind of character who Kirk really isn't in the old stuff. If you watch the original series and you watch the original movies,
right.
Kirk doesn't actually live up to the womanizer tag that he's been given over the last, you know, 50 years.
Right. It's much more tame. And some of that's due to the time frame in which it was, you know, the 2009 movie versus the show
sure.
is concerned. But I actually have a theory for this, and maybe we've discussed this before, but I think that this is the result of an alternate timeline Kirk who didn't grow up with a father who showed him what it meant to be masculine in a way that wasn't hypersexualized. And I think, I mean, you know, same character, one grew up with a father that was very, he was very close to. They had some issues, as they kind of allude to, but he was close to his dad. And his dad was at least a presence in his life. But Pines Kirk was different.
That's a really interesting point, because we know it's a separate timeline, right? This is the Kelvin timeline. It's not the Prime timeline, and there is a split there, which, for the record, I've always appreciated that Abrams found an in-universe, play-by-the-rules way to break himself free from canon. I do appreciate Absolutely. That. He didn't just ignore canon. He used the rules to do what he wanted to do. We don't really talk about what the splinters are from all of that, and there's a lot of little things that you can attribute to that.
Womanizing Kirk and more emotional Spock are the two biggest ones.
Absolutely.
So I can appreciate that. And, you know, just small things like giving Uhura a first name.
Yeah.
Is pretty great. Like, Nyota has been adopted into canon now. And so I appreciate that. But she didn't have a first name. And
well, she did in the books.
Did she?
Yeah. There's books where she had her name. It just
either way, Roddenberry never gave her a name. So yes,
that's true.
Abrams naming her and adding Nyota, it's been awesome.
And I like the relationship between Spock and Uhura because it actually harkens back to the original series and the original intent of what was written in the script, which was that the kiss was supposed to be between Spock and Uhura, not Kirk and Uhura. And we can argue about whether or not that would have been as significant culturally because Spock is an alien and not actually a white dude right. for the first interracial kiss. But from a story perspective, those seeds between Spock and Uhura were there from the beginning.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's the Vulcan.
Second episode or third episode where she sings to him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. And he's playing the, I can't remember the name of the Vulcan instrument. Liar. Now. Yeah, basically. Whatever. Right. Like, that was there. And this basically stokes that into making it a real thing. And mm-hmm. I like that.
I agree.
I thought that was really cool. There's some other things that the timeline, you know, may have caused issues with that I don't know if are just oversights or me being nitpicky, but some of it is timeline problems.
Such as?
The Enterprise. So, mm-hmm.
The Enterprise.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we're jumping ahead too much.
I want you to finish your thought, and then I'll jump in.
Let's go back to it, because I don't want to skip over the Kobayashi Maru.
I don't want to either. I think it's really cool that he's eating an apple, and when he described the test in Wrath of Khan, he was also eating an apple. Like, small callbacks like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it was on purpose or not.
Yes.
I
absolutely believe that was on purpose.
Yeah.
Yes.
I never knew.
Well, we certainly know that J.J. Abrams has seen The Wrath of Khan.
Sure.
As we'll discuss next week.
I never knew what Kirk was eating in The Wrath of Khan. It seemed like, it didn't sound like an apple when
Shatner
he bit into it.
Shatner confirmed it to Pine when they talked.
It was an apple?
Yeah.
Okay.
Shatner knows what he ate.
Of course he knows. I know he knows. I don't know.
But now you do. Now we all know.
Now we know. No, that's a cool scene. I liked seeing an updated Kobayashi Maru, since we do see it in The Wrath of Khan,
yes.
You know, in the older style, we get to see an updated version of it. It's basically the same test. Mm-hmm. They didn't change it, which I also thought was cool, because why bother, right? And I'm a little surprised at how blatant the cheating was. Like, I figured it'd be something really sneaky, but, like, the whole system shuts down, it turns back on, and everything's fine.
Yeah.
Like, they're gonna figure that out, Jim. Like,
yeah. Know? He's not sneaky.
Because, like, the whole thing was he changed the conditions of the test. Well, I don't know. I guess in my head I had built that up to be something a little bit sneakier.
The fact that he was just gonna get, like, an academic grounding, you know, like, a Starfleet house arrest, that was going to be it. And
well, no, we don't know what the outcome would have been. He was only grounded from that thing because he was under
probation. Well, he was grounded probation. For 2 weeks, didn't they say? Like, until they could reconvene and...
Until they could reconvene, yeah. But if he had actually been, like, convicted, so to speak, he may have been expelled.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like, we don't really know. We don't get to know because of the convenience of the story.
Oh, man, yeah. I really wanted it to follow that storyline.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, it's that idea of, like, well, you know, yeah, he cheated, but he's also just really good at his job, so...
And that's basically the model for, you know, capitalism.
But I like the Kobayashi Maru scene because of how sarcastic both Bones and Uhura are to Jim in this scene. Yes. It's just really great.
A lot is being indirectly communicated, and it's fantastic.
All right, so let's move on to the Enterprise, like we were saying a few minutes ago. So let's take a little history lesson jaunt here for a moment. So we know that Kirk is not the first captain of the Enterprise. We know that Pike was captain before Kirk.
And April was captain before Pike.
So here's my problem.
It's a little fuzzy.
So in the prime timeline, the Enterprise launched in 2245 under Robert April.
Nerd.
And Kirk would not take over until 2264. Okay? That's a big gap.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the Enterprise is essentially 20 years old when Kirk gets a hold of it. Okay? Now, in this movie, we're looking at the year 2258 is when the attack on Vulcan occurs.
Yes.
Okay? And Pike makes the comment about how, you know, be careful with the ship, she's new. Right?
Right.
You know, careful with the ship, Spock, she's new.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. So let's analyze that for a moment here. What does new mean? Is this the maiden voyage of the Enterprise? He says that later, right? Deserves more pomp and circumstance and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So first off, that means the Enterprise is 13 years newer in this timeline.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert April never captained it.
Right.
So my question would be, what about the destruction of the Kelvin would delay the Constitution-class starship by more than a decade?
You clearly have nothing.
That would be my question. Right now, you know, arguments could be made that the designs of the ships had changed because maybe the Kelvin had an officer on it who was responsible for designing the Constitution-class starship. Right?
I think the easier explanation is that Pike is the first captain of it, not April.
Sure. But the ship is still delayed in construction by 13 years.
Which is significant.
So that's two different issues. One is, what happened to April? But then I guess that's answered by, well, if the Enterprise didn't exist 13 years before, then he was given a different ship.
Right.
So why wasn't the Constitution class, which was the most important flagship class of ship, there were 12 of them that were sent out, you know, into the galaxy. These were the big bad ships to fight the D7 battlecruisers.
This is already an alternate timeline by this point. And, you know, maybe April captained the Farragut. And, you know, Kirk isn't on the Farragut, so...
Right.
Because he was supposed to be...
This likely has, like, a really, like, stupid... Okay, the ultimate answer is it was just a careless mistake. but if you want to find a real answer, we can make one up that's just super mundane and boring. Like, the incursion of Nero, due to that, like, the Federation had to reallocate their resources for a number of projects, and the Enterprise, which they wanted to pour a lot of time and effort into, got delayed because they spent a few extra years right after that trying to figure out what they were doing. I don't know.
I guess, yeah, I suppose.
It's not a good answer, but there is no good answer when sloppy shit happens.
I'm trying to be fair, because I harped on Spider-Man Homecoming for creating a pretty big time plot hole in the MCU.
Oh, and it was so bad.
And,
I don't even know if I remember that one.
Well, they make the mistake of specifically saying time periods in Spider-Man. And
that was a mistake.
Rather than things like years ago or months from now, which gets you around a lot of stuff because those are a little more subjective.
Yeah.
And at least in this, in Star Trek 2009, there's not as much specifics of the years. That's more in Memory Alpha, which is the canon wiki for Star Trek. Right. So, you know, I'm a little more slack, I guess, is deserved there. But the moral of the story is Kirk basically gets the Enterprise about 6 years early.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So my inconsistency issue with the Romulans is that in the comic book that they created to kind of show the Nero timeline.
Countdown, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They explain that the tattoos are for mourning. They shave their heads and tattooed tribal Romulan symbols on their face for mourning their family. When Nero recounts the situation to Pike, and you get to see the holograms, he already had the facial tattoos. Like, that's a coal mining thing, I guess, because, or mining whatever that they do, whatever fuel they're mining. So that was my issue. Like, they tried to explain it away, and I like the idea that they're mourning tattoos, but they're not. They're just, these guys are Romulan skinheads. Like,
yeah, the Narada has a lot of problems from a consistency standpoint. Yeah. So it comes from the future, right? This is a post Nemesis ship.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still a mining vessel. Right. And it's a mining vessel that would, like, be able to hold its own against the Enterprise E.
It's so 5 miles wide and 15 miles long. And why in the heck did they hire Zachary Quinto's brother to be a Romulan? I had to do so many double takes because he is clearly unseen. Zachary Quinto's brother plays a Romulan, and when they transport over, I seriously was like, why would they have Quinto play two roles? That's just silly.
Wow.
And it's clearly Quinto's brother.
I definitely missed that.
I seriously thought it was Quinto himself. And
I've never noticed that before. That's fascinating. Okay.
Yes.
Well, that's pretty funny.
Thank you.
The ship, though, just the Narada doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. The design of it seems strange. It doesn't seem in line with anything the Romulans have ever designed before. And it seems to be, like, a pretty powerful frickin' ship, right? I mean, it's not that fast, I guess, since the Enterprise could catch up with it going warp 4. So how fast could it possibly be? But I don't know. I guess I just have some problems with that. Because it's from a time period that's less than 10 years after Nemesis.
Right.
Right? Why is it that freaking powerful? It's got a million torpedo launchers, you know, and it's massive in size. And then here's where one of the other consistencies come in. So they go to Vulcan. The Enterprise warps in the Vulcan and the whole fleet's completely destroyed. Not disabled. Completely destroyed.
Right.
So you're telling me in the span of 3 minutes, the Narada was able to dispatch an entire fleet of starships, but wasn't able to stop the Kelvin from running into it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not great. These are the things that I appreciate talking about movies with you, Derek. This is why I appreciate talking about movies with you. Because a lot of these things, like, I just, like, tune out. I'm having a good time. There are a few occasions where something so glaringly terrible happens that I am right there with you. But for the most part, I don't even think of these things until you point it out or until I've seen it 10 times.
It's tough because on one hand, it creates a cool shot, right? The Enterprise warps into a debris field. They've got to drop under the one saucer section, right? And it clips the nacelle. Like, it's a cool shot. They had the wide shot where the Enterprise is kind of like twisting in a way, right?
Yeah.
Right? It's a cool scene. But then why was the Kelvin able to hold its own by itself years earlier, almost 30 years earlier, right?
Yeah.
That just makes no sense to me. You know, the Enterprise is able to hold its own for longer because he doesn't actually want to kill Spock.
Sure.
Right? He's not trying to take out the Enterprise, but he did want to take out the rest of the fleet and the Kelvin.
Right.
You know, so It's little things
all
like
fair.
That.
All fair.
Okay, so we do have that, the introduction. I actually really like Nero. I like Eric Bana's portrayal of Nero.
He's very unassuming, like, hi.
Hi, Christopher, I'm Nero.
Yeah, very kind of the antithesis of what we see with a lot of Trek villains. With like, there's an overblown ego, which Nero definitely has ego issues. But it's like, he's so unassuming when he meets you. He's just this weird kind of neurotic guy instead of being all like, I am Nero. I mean, they could have gotten away with that with a name like Nero even, but they chose a more unassuming path.
Ray disagrees.
No, it's fine. I love Nero a lot. I think Eric Bana did a great job. It was very difficult to recognize him as Eric Bana, and yeah. I wasn't...
That was good.
I'm not the only one. Like, apparently Steven Spielberg and Cameron Crowe had no idea who played Nero, even though they both had seen Eric Bana many times. So, you know, twice. Like, he was great. Nero was great. I love him as a villain. He is a very... He's like an angry con, you know? He's smart. He knows what he's doing, and he can be patient and wait out Spock. So, but he's definitely more emotional than Khan is. So, you know, you get the anger and mm-hmm. the loss and the pain that he feels. So I like Nero.
And that's the thing. I love Bana's portrayal of Nero. So yeah. I don't want to knock on Bana at all. My only problem with the Nero character is the story that's told doesn't seem to like put really any blame on Spock. Like, the Vulcans were going out of their way to help the Romulans and couldn't make it in time.
Right.
So if Spock didn't exist, then the supernova destroys Romulus anyway. Mm-hmm. Right?
But this is a man torn by grief and trauma, and he's not thinking about logic.
Yeah.
He can blame Spock, and I have no problem with him blaming Spock. His motives don't have to make sense. He is racked with grief at this point.
Yeah, but then he's going to go so far as to destroy the entire Federation. Like, it just seems to be a bit of a leap from what's really a natural disaster. As horrible as it is a natural disaster, and wanting to commit genocide.
I mean, terrorist attacks rarely have a logical motive.
Mm-hmm. No, they usually
genocide.
Have...
Genocide never has a justifiable or logical motive, anyway. So we're it doesn't bother me. I'm not saying that you're wrong to have that critique at all, but like for me, it's just like, dude's crazy. I mean,
and I actually think that he's the best out of all the three Kelvin villains. I think Krall didn't get nearly as much development as he deserved. And I'm okay with it in the end because the cast got a lot more development than they had in 09 and Into Darkness. And of course, you know, the whole, we don't know who the bad guy is, Cumberbatch or Welker, Welker, Cumberbatch, like... It just flip-flops so much that, you know, there is no clear villain. I think the villain in number two is Abrams.
No, I mean, we'll get to that one next week.
But, right, yeah. But I just think that Nero is the best and the most Star Trek of all the Star Trek villains.
He's a good villain. He really is. My issues have more to do with, like, the ship. You know,
what are they mining with that thing? Like,
I assume dilithium.
Yeah,
that's kind of like the thing everybody and deuterium and
red matter.
You know, well, let's put the MacGuffin aside for a minute. So the red matter thing is pretty funny to me because it's really never discussed ever again in anything else.
No, nor should it be. Except we're gonna do it here now.
I guess it's in some of the comics. But.
That stuff is powerful. Like, a bead of red matter can destroy an entire planet.
That's not even that. Nimoy, or Spock, was going to use the same amount to shut down a supernova.
Right.
Which, to our knowledge, is, you know, one of the most powerful forces in the entire universe. You know, so...
Sometimes, you know, the Federation does bad things with good intentions. It did kind of... cross my mind that some people would be interested in keeping that around, not plunging all of it into Nero and creating this giant black hole, but, you know, just keeping some for themselves later on as a war deterrent or something.
Well, but the Enterprise crew doesn't want to do that.
The Enterprise crew does not, but that's, I have a feeling that other people would.
Yeah, so. Peter Weller's Admiral Marcus wanted to do that in the following film, but... You know, that wasn't where Star Trek was going yet. And the Enterprise crew, that's not who they are, right? Kirk and Spock wouldn't necessarily do that, even though, you know, Spock gives pause to the lending a hand to...
Well, in Insurrection, the Admiral would have wanted to do that.
Exactly.
So that's the always... The story is the Admirals are bad.
The Admirals are always bad unless it's Janeway.
Yes.
And then in the books, it's a little murky, but, you know... Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, though, right? The Enterprise crew is there to do the right thing in the end. Even if they struggle getting there, they do the right thing. That's the whole point. And, I mean, we'll get to the very end where they do destroy all the red matter, because I want to talk about that scene.
So let's talk about that now, because, I mean, we're getting close on time and everything.
Well, but we haven't talked about Vulcan yet. You know, or even the introduction of Scotty and the original Spock as Nimoy, and
So I want to talk about the skydiving scene.
Okay.
Because I think it's absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Like, I love the way it looks. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Absolutely beautiful. They had the gorgeous scene shooting down on Vulcan and showing that gorgeous planet, and the drill looked amazing. It looked scary. It looked, you know, doom impending. I get that. What the hell was Olsen thinking? Like, even the dumbest red shirt never voluntarily died like that. Like,
well, then they have to have the throwaway line of, Olsen had the charges.
Yeah, like, what? Yeah. Really? You're going to let the one guy who's not a major cast member have the charges? No.
Bad choice.
I mean, I forgot his name was Olsen because I really honestly thought it was Ensign Ricky.
Well, like, Pike doesn't even acknowledge him.
Yeah.
Doesn't even, like, look at him. Why would he give the charges to him? It should have been Sulu.
I mean, so from a... If you take out the tropes for a moment, from an actual in-universe explanation, as the security and engineering shirt guy, he would have been responsible for the charges. Like, that's consistent for, like, an operational perspective.
Yeah.
Right?
I'll give it to you.
But it is just kind of silly. The dude's so reckless. Like, he picked the most reckless person on the ship. that makes for kind of a silly, like, I get it, it's the red shirt trope that doesn't really exist, but people want to exist.
You know, there's other ways to do that. Spock could have brought down multiple people to help him save Vulcan members, you know?
Like, oh, absolutely.
That could have been your opportunity, and then the person dies tragically in, you know, a natural disaster, unnatural disaster, and not of, you know, being an idiot.
I agree with you, but then you don't have the excuse to have Sulu do his fencing.
Yes, you do. The Romulan still comes out.
I guess.
Like.
But then you don't have the cool transporters.
Rachel's thought this through.
I can use that.
No. No. You could totally still have it. You could still have everything. The charges don't have to work. Or, like, Olsen just didn't have to... There's not one red shirt that just voluntarily goes to his death like that.
That's... Okay. I get your point.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's fair.
Thank you.
So we do have the Spock beaming down scene. I think it's a little silly because A, he beams down really far away from the entrance to that cavern.
But he did it like Arnold. Like,
yeah, why was he crouched down? Like, yeah. It's a cool shot in the trailer and all, but like, why?
Yeah.
It would have made more sense had he protected his head. There was a lot of falling debris. If he had had it like this,
yeah,
that would have made sense. But they didn't do that. They just wanted the Arnold scene.
And... Or if they were like beaming him in like right next to the door and there's like an overhang. Yeah. Or like, give me some reason for him to Terminator that. Yeah. At least he wasn't naked, right?
I mean, says you. I would have loved that. Quinto's very attractive.
R-rated Star Trek. There it is. Anyway, so they go into the big...
Lower decks indeed.
I'm going to make sure you have zero listeners by the time my run's done here.
That's fine.
I'm going to ostracize all of them.
That's fine. So I get that they want to kill off his mother, Winona Ryder. Because
he's only 6 years older than him.
Yeah. So there isn't there's a explanation for that. So they actually were supposed to have a scene where she gives birth to Spock.
Very similar to the Kirk.
Right. But they cut it. And so that's why they cast her, because they wanted her to look young, and then they were going to age her up with the makeup that they did do, you know, to make her old enough to be the mother. And that didn't quite work out. But you still got Winona Ryder, and I love her, so I'm fine with it.
Yeah. At the time, it was easier to age up an actor instead of age them down.
I think it still is easier.
Probably.
Less expensive.
I don't know. They animated Nero's mouth in a lot of scenes towards the end after some fight scenes, and they animated Nimoy's mouth, so on Hoth with the Wampa. That's what that is. That is Hoth with the Wampa. That is exactly what that is. You cannot tell me any different.
So, all right.
If we're going to talk about that scene, I want to briefly interject, because this is relevant.
Please do.
This, as a side note, because we haven't spoken about it yet, and we can talk more about it in the next couple films, too, but Giacchino is a brilliant composer. And not all films use him to his maximum capacity, but it was very clear that he did his research. And in that scene, where Kirk's getting chased by the Wampa, that's what we're calling it, it's canon. Don't at me.
I thought they smelled bad on the outside.
But that scene, if you listen to it, the music that's being played is very reminiscent of, like, the Danger music from the original series show. Like, he took some chords straight out of the original series and made it his own in a very cinematic and creative way. And that was a nice, very subtle nudge or nod.
Oh, yeah. I can easily say that his music in the three Star Trek Kelvin films are some of the best work in those three movies.
They're some of his best work. Like he does most of the Pixar films. Mm-hmm. Like, he's done Marvel. He's done DC. Like, he's been around.
Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Like, but a lot of it, everything he's done is good, but not everything he's done has as much love as what he did with Trek.
It's an amazing score. Yeah. It really is.
I did lean into you and I told you how much I love the trope where big giant thing is chasing person and even huger thing like comes and eats that giant thing. So yeah, I love that trope.
It's the T-Rex trope.
Yeah. Yep.
In Jurassic Park. I that might be the first movie that did it.
I think you're right.
Maybe. You know, maybe. And, I don't know, but the Wampa got eaten by like a giant Demogorgon.
Yep.
That was great.
That's what I saw.
Stranger Things totally rips that look off. Watching it, that thing is like Spider Demogorgon, and it's going to be in the third season, I promise you.
So that leads us to Keenzer and Scotty.
And yes. Nimoy.
And yes, so Nimoy, of course.
Keenzer is my favorite addition to the crew.
He is so great.
I love Keenzer.
Keenzer's awesome.
Yeah.
They really failed. All these movies really failed their merchandising. Like, the fact that I don't own a plush Keenzer is a travesty.
Agreed.
Well, the toys for these movies were almost non-existent. I mean, 2009 yes. had some toys, but not that bad. Many. They weren't great. I don't even think Into Darkness had any.
It's like they didn't want to sell merchandise.
I mean, more or less, they didn't really try to. And then they blamed, you know, low sales for, you know, cutting, you know, each movie and,
right.
you know, whatever. But, So let's talk about Nimoy for a minute. It's a great role for him. I mean, he steps right back into it. There's really no question about it. He looks great for the part. Uh-huh. The mind meld scene is super cool.
The fact that Pine walks away emotionally rattled by all of it is great because, you know, the Vulcans train themselves to suppress their emotions and rationalize through them to work through them. But he doesn't have that, so he's getting all of the emotions of seeing Romulus explode, of seeing Vulcan explode, and, you know, it affects him.
Absolutely. It's a really well-done scene that way. And, you know, at the very end of the movie when the two Spocks meet, of course, is a wonderful moment as well.
Yes.
You lied. Implied.
I implied. And it's great because they always find some other way for him to skirt the lying rule, right? It's like, I exaggerated. You know, I omitted.
Yeah. You know? Which is a huge indication of who Spock is by the time we get to these films as opposed to who he was like in the original series. Because like you mentioned, there was that growth in him where he did relax, largely in part due to his friendship with Captain Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great moment. You know, I am not our father is one of my favorite lines.
So great.
It's so well written. It's a great line. It's well delivered. And it's a cool moment between the two of them.
Yeah. What does he say? My normal greeting would seem...
oddly self-serving.
Yes, that's the phrase.
So I will simply say good luck.
Yes.
which is also great. And Quinto has his fingers glued together in that scene because he can't do the Vulcan salute any better than I can.
In all fairness, Abrams sent him to like classes to work on it and he still couldn't do it. And Abrams said, I'm going to super glue your fingers together. And that's what he did.
Well, look, Quinto, if you're out there listening, as I'm sure you are, I can't do it either. And people make fun of me for it. And so it's good to know that you can't either.
I couldn't up Shatter until...
Yeah.
I couldn't up until 2016. I practiced because I was dating a Trekkie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Weird.
And now I can.
Huh.
Good for you.
So maybe if you wanted it bad enough, Derek, you could do it.
Just took practice. All right. So, Scotty. I love Simon Pegg's Scotty. I like him more in each film.
Yeah. He's the best part of this trilogy. I like him
more than James Doohan.
Yeah.
It's a little tough for me because I remember Scotty as the older Scotty in the movies and in Relics and TNG. That's what I think of when I think of Scotty.
That's fair.
That's just what resonated with me. When I think Scotty, that's who I remember.
Well, you started with TNG and went back to TOS, right?
I mean, it was really both at the same time. My dad just watched both of them all the time. But that's just, those movies I probably ran into the ground more than anything else. And so that's how I picture Scotty.
Right.
Right. And so I don't know necessarily that Simon Pegg is better for me, but he is so good.
He's amazing, yeah. And I really feel like, and we'll talk more about this over the next couple films, but I really feel like he does a good job of embodying what Star Trek is supposed to be about.
It is interesting. He is kind of like the compass of Trek
in
this particular cast.
Yeah. And I mean, I came into this movie, like, everyone was so well cast, and I came into this movie already a huge Simon Pegg fan. So for his character to be so well done throughout this trilogy, it was awesome. And I will go to my grave a Simon Pegg fan, assuming he doesn't, you know, become an asshole.
I'm with you there, right? Because I had known him from some other films, like the Cornetto trilogy movies and that
sort
of thing.
Yeah, he had already been in two.
I think he had done the first two.
I thought so.
Yeah.
At least the first two.
Well, because The World's End was 2012, I think, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, I think he had already done the first two.
And most people who saw those went back and watched Spaced because of it. Yes. So, you know.
He's just a delight to have in those movies. It's great. Yeah. He's like, they're telling him he's from the future. He's like, yeah, sure, whatever. They have sandwiches there. Like, he doesn't believe them at all.
Like, I just want a full meal.
Yeah.
Which is so great.
What do you mean you're hungry? You're so small. All you need is a pee and you're done. You're full.
I've never transported three people from two locations on the one pad before.
Yeah.
It's just fun.
I told you, like, that makes me think of you. He got so excited about his accomplishments that, you know, that's what he was bragging about instead of talking about this, like, life-altering, world-ending, life-or-death thing going on right now. And I thought that was a total you moment because, you know, you call me when you solve a really intense computer issue and you're like, guess what I just did? So it reminded me of you.
That's adorable.
Fair enough. I'll take it. All right, so we've covered most of the film at this point. There's a couple cool moments left. I love the scene with Titan, the moon. It's just a beautifully shot scene when the Enterprise rises out of the clouds. It's just cool. It's a really beautiful shot.
So pretty.
Very, very well done. And the battle sequence is cool. It's a cool moment, you know.
It's an acceptable battle.
It's fine. I like when the Enterprise swoops in to save Spock on the squid ship in the last moment. It's a cool shot.
Yeah,
which is neat.
A lot of cool shots in this film.
Then the movie, like, the ending kind of goes off the rails a little bit when they detonate all the red matter and the ship can't pull away. Now I like the whole we're at warp. I like that. I thought that was kind of a cool moment, right? Like, they're at maximum and they're going nowhere, right? So then they eject the core. Now, I don't care that the core is a bunch of little cores. I don't care. Like, fine. If that's how you want to design it, whatever. What bothers me here is they've ejected the core while traveling at warp. They've ejected the warp core while traveling at warp.
Yeah.
And don't slow down. And then the explosion that should destroy the ship because, you know, the warp core breaches have happened on Star Trek a couple of times, rockets them forward faster than their maximum warp speed.
Look, science, man.
That just bothers me. That makes no sense to me at all.
No, I agree. Like, it's a cool thing. It's a cool easy out, and that's all it is.
Well, then to make matters worse, that piece just followed a piece that also makes no sense, where the Narada is being destroyed. They offer to help, right? And you have that cool moment between Kirk and Spock, which I think is a really good character moment, right?
Yeah.
Showing compassion, Spock, maybe it's the only way to have peace with Romulus, you know, logic. You know, I thought you'd like that. And Spock's like, no, not this time. Right. Yeah. It's a good character moment.
Their budding bromance throughout this film is
very well done. Yeah. Right. And then immediately after that, they just launch a bunch of weapons at the Narada because, you know, Nero doesn't want any help. Okay. Nero doesn't want any help. You've already said that their ship's compromised and they can't survive without your help. Why would you then destroy them? Because first off, aside, let's put the ammo aside for a minute here. Doesn't that mean they just, like, basically murdered those people who could no longer cause a threat?
Yeah.
Pose a threat, excuse me?
Yes.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem very Kirk Spock Enterprise to me.
But it seems very much like, hey, we wrote ourselves into a hole. Like, I've seen that in Trek happen before. I've seen that in Batman, and, you know, they write themselves into a corner, and then the best they can do is offer up, you know, the worst possible options, or, you know, maybe it looks good, but when you think about it, it's horrible. Like,
yeah.
I mean, the best comparison I have is when they made Superman snap Zod's neck. Like,
in Man of Steel. We've talked about that one. Yeah,
yeah, that, I harp on that a lot because I think it's one of the worst writing.
It's not good.
No.
So, all right. So we move on. We're back. Time has passed. Kirk is no longer in trouble. In fact, he's promoted to captain straight up from a cadet. He goes from a cadet on probation to captain in a matter of like 3 days.
All the other cadets are full on crew members now. Like, there's no graduation.
And I feel a little bad for some of them because I think Uhura was the only cadet, the only other cadet, because it seemed like Sulu, Chekov, Bones, and Spock were all full crew members already, as was Scotty down on the station.
Right.
Bones' position seems odd. Like, he joined the new recruits on the same day that Kirk did. So was he a cadet? Did they hire him on as, like, a school doctor? Like,
so I have a theory about that.
Experience.
I think he was a doctor.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And so basically it's kind of like if you did,
he flat out says, like, I am a doctor. I don't need a doctor.
It's kind of like if you did, like, ROTC or something like that in high school and then go into the military, you're brought in at a higher level.
Yeah.
I wonder if it was something like that. He was already an MD. He had experience as an MD, and they basically just had to train him in the Starfleet aspects of the space, you know, portion of it. And then he's a doctor. So he's not that chief medical officer when we first meet him. He becomes that later in the movie, right? Because of the deaths. But he doesn't start that
convenient
way.
Deaths.
He just starts off as one of the doctors, which, I mean, let's be honest, it makes more sense that a ship like the Enterprise would have, you know, a couple of doctors. Discovery has fixed that a bit too, because Discovery has multiple doctors. Like, that makes a lot more sense to me than, you know, one.
Yeah.
But, you know, and then Chekov is the whiz kid. He's already an officer, as is Sulu. So really it's just Uhura and Kirk who are the real cadets.
That's fair. Well, at least, you know, she got promoted too.
She did. And I mean, you know, she gets to boot out that lieutenant. So she skips up from ensign straight to lieutenant, I guess, too. Mm-hmm. So
A lot of skipping around.
It does have one of my favorite little nods, which is Pike in the wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
And basically wearing Kirk's admiral uniform from the motion picture. But, you know, nicer. Yes.
I am relieved.
It's a cool moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's good to see Bruce Greenwood again as Pike. I think he's a wonderful Pike. And it's a nice little nod to the original series and what happened with Jeffrey Hunter's Pike.
For sure.
I'm very curious as to what actually damaged him. Because, you know, very obvious that he underwent a ton of torture, including the little ear space worm thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what all that thing caused internally. Just, I work in the medical field, so I'm actually curious, like, what injury caused him to be paralyzed.
Well, so he's not paralyzed, because by the next movie, he's okay.
Oh, right.
He's not paralyzed. So here's what I think happened. This is just my headcanon. So the Centurion beetle slug, they put it in his mouth. They don't have the babies in his ear. So I'm wondering if they had to surgically remove it.
Interesting.
And maybe because of that, he can't, like, stand and walk around right now. Because it seems like the time gap's only maybe a couple of weeks.
Right.
Right? So maybe he had to have, like, serious surgery to have that removed.
Yeah.
And he's just not healed yet. It was kind of how I took it, since he's fine in the next movie.
Okay.
So.
That's fair.
It's a valid experience.
Maybe he had to pass it.
And he did that morning, and that's why he can't stand up anymore.
Even worse.
Worst hemorrhoids ever.
I was going to say, like, can you imagine the damage those things that do coming out?
So,
as a side note real quick, since we're talking about Starfleet, and maybe one of you know the answer to this, what the hell is Tyler Perry doing there?
He's the president of Starfleet.
Well, I know, but, like, that actor, like, what? Okay, he's a Trekkie?
Yeah. He approached Abrams.
Okay, I didn't know what the backstory was, and I always forget until I rewatch him, like, oh yeah, he's in this.
It's like Samuel L. Jackson approaching Lucas.
Sure.
Only Samuel L. Jackson can act, and Perry can't, so otherwise, he may have had a much bigger role if he was Samuel L. Jackson.
Wow. Yeah.
Come on, it's true, you know it.
So, little things, you know, you've got the Scotty line about Admiral Archer's prized beagle.
Yeah.
It can't be Porthos, though. So, I know
everyone's age. As far as we know, dogs still only live, like, 10 to 15 years in this.
Well, even if you think, like, we've expanded our life. Yeah. Like, we live to be 150 to 200 years old.
So maybe they live to 25.
So they live to be 50?
Oh, wow.
I mean, like, even that seems like on the high end.
It does.
And Porthos still wouldn't be alive by this point.
Yeah.
This is 100 years later.
Yeah. I just, you know,
why is Archer still alive?
Well, because he'd only be like 130.
God, but still, at what cost?
I want to see Bakula in 130-year-old makeup now.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
But seriously, like, I know everyone wants it to be Porthos, but there's just no reasonable
way.
So
instead, he is just a beagle owner. Like, when one passes, he gets another beagle. There are dog owners like that.
There are.
Yes.
Then there's dog owners like me that lose a black lab and then a year later adopt a white cat.
All about the extremes.
I feel like there's like an underworld god connection here or something.
Probably.
So as we wrap up here, little things. How do you guys feel about the aesthetics, the uniforms,
God,
for example?
I hate the Enterprise. I hate the Enterprise so much.
Shiny. Looks like the inside of an Apple store.
The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, this is beautiful. And last night, after I've gone through and I've watched all the other movies,
mm-hmm.
and this is the first time I've watched the 09 films since I've seen all the other ones.
Same.
No, that is not the bridge. That's the Genius Bar.
Yes.
Like, that, and all the lens flare, it is so bad.
It's excessive.
So bad.
I kind of thought, like, maybe it had just become a joke for everybody to make fun of the lens flare.
Nope,
and then we
totally
rewatched it, and like, man, it is everywhere in that movie.
It's distracting. It got in the way. Like, it's all of a sudden right in front of Bruce Greenwood's face. And I'm like, he did not sign on for that. You're disrespecting Bruce Greenwood.
Right.
That is a Batman right there. Like, screw you.
God, I always forget that.
Yeah, right.
Well, so what did you think about the exterior of the ship, the design of the ship?
Of course, that's pretty.
It's pretty.
It's pretty.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Enterprise. It's a Constitution-class ship. I don't think there's any
Kelvin's
argument.
The Kelvin's pretty. The Narada's pretty looking.
I like the Kelvin a lot.
Enterprise is pretty. Like,
nacelle was really cool.
Yeah.
The models that they made for this looked amazing. They look like they belong in this world, and I appreciate that. Now, obviously, as we dig deeper into the Narada and we just go inside on the Enterprise, it looks awful, but, you know.
Fair enough. I mean, yeah, the whole engine room is actually the Budweiser plant in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
So bad.
Which I didn't quite believe until I actually got to tour the brewery, and, like, yeah, that's totally it.
I kind of, like, I don't care at all about beer or that particular look for the engine room, but I do kind of want to go. It's St. Louis. It's not that far. I kind of want to tour and take some photos just, you know, for the sake of saying I was in the...
We should go sometime.
We
fun.
Should. That'd be
it
a fun really trip, fun. Yeah.
Like, if I ever see the Redwoods, I'm going to do what Ben does on Parks and Rec and be like, I'm on indoors!
Yes, exactly. yes.
So, okay, so what about the uniforms?
They're simplistic, just mm-hmm. like the TOS ones were.
Yeah.
And I kind of expected them to be a little bit more, but they're made out of jersey knit, and that stuff's really cheap. Like, there's a reason why they give that to people in sports. Like, it's because it's a cheap fabric, but it's also durable and doesn't stain very badly. So, you know, I like the look, the aesthetic, but getting up close as a costume designer, like, they could have done more.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if it was this one or one of the later films that when you zoom in on him, it's got the little...
That's this one.
Okay, the Delta Shield.
Yeah, yeah, all over.
Yeah, which is cool, but I mean, meh, whatever.
Fair enough. We talked a lot about budget last week for Nemesis because of the low budget that Nemesis had. This one, they tried. It got $150 million.
Yeah, that's a decent amount.
And, you know, I mean, Aquaman today, 10 years later, is getting $165.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? So they gave it money. They really did. It grossed a little over $385 million internationally.
That's great.
$257.7 domestically. And so for some perspective here...
The rest is all from Jordan.
I mean, it might be. It is the not adjusted, this is just straight cash, it is the highest grossing Star Trek film by a pretty good margin. The top three are all the Kelvin films, each one making less money, which again is why there's some discussion around the fourth film and renegotiating contracts, because the Beyond only made 158 domestically.
Yeah.
You know,
which is criminal.
And then, you know, there's a pretty steep drop off. Voyage Home made 109, and those are the only ones that made over 100. Mm. You know,
the whale movie. The whale.
It was very accessible.
Yeah,
that's fair.
It was very family friendly.
As was this one, very accessible.
As was this one, yep.
Easy jumping on point.
It was great because, I mean, it's just named Star Trek. They don't have a subtitle to it, which. Yeah. You know, is pretty good. It means, hey, this is a starting point for new fans.
Absolutely. And that was very much on purpose.
Yeah.
If you do adjust it for inflation, then the 09 film is still number one for the domestic number. But number two is the original motion picture, actually, followed by The Voyage Home. That's the top three if you adjust for inflation there.
Cool.
With the 09 one being the only one over 300. So... on Twitter, we did a poll. We've been doing polls for these, asking people, you know, how you feel about the movie. And 80% of our audience thought that 61%. What was I looking at? I don't even know. 61% of our audience gave the 2009 film an A rating, with 30% giving it a B, and 4% a C, as well as 4% a D or lower. So, you know, 91% of the audience out there thinks it's at least a B or above, which is pretty good. Where would you guys rate this one?
Like overall, or just with Kelvinverse, or just like
if you want to give me any of that, whatever you feel comfortable with.
Well, I think we all agree that Beyond's the best Kelvin film. 09 is the second, and Into Darkness is the last. And
like, I switch those two.
You would? Really?
Well, next week's gonna be rough.
Next week. To be fair, I haven't watched Into Darkness in a while, and there is a chance that I will come here and say like, "Nope, you're right. I hate it. It's the worst."
I have controversial things to say about that film.
Yeah.
Too. It's like, I love the Klingons, and every time I say that, I feel like violence is going to be inflicted on me.
Yeah.
But...
No, I have a lot of unpopular opinions about that movie, and it's one that, like, I don't think it's the best Trek. I don't think it's an objectively great film. I'll get into it more next week. We'll see how I feel about it, because it's been a couple years. But, it's one that there are enough really good moments and pieces about it that I enjoy. So.
Okay. So as of today, you would
As of today, I would put that... I think they get progressively better.
But we all can agree that...
No, Beyond is easily the best, yeah.
Okay, so from a letter grade perspective, are we saying an A, a B,
a C?
I'd do a B. A solid B.
Okay.
B-plus, maybe?
I mentioned to you, and I mentioned on social media before I rewatched this, that this is a film that I usually like less every time I see it. I have the same problem with the first X-Men movie. Every time I watch it, I see more holes. That being said, it's been long enough now that rewatching this the other night, I didn't like it less.
Good.
Maybe I've reached
a plateau.
I plateaued, yeah. It's fun, it does enough things right, and it definitely sets up some really cool stuff to happen in the subsequent films, so, yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah, I give it, like, an A-.
Yeah.
I don't watch it that often. Maybe once every 18 to 24 months I get around to watching it, right? And so, for that reason, I don't ever get sick of any of it, and I don't quite remember, you know, the negativity around it. I remember the positive stuff from this one, because...
Sure.
I mean, seeing it in theaters was kind of a big deal. I went with my dad, I went with a couple of friends, and, like, it was a really big deal. We had, like, the IMAX theater had like the split row thing. We had the front of that split row. Like, it was a pretty like big night. And so I remember all the positive stuff about this one, which probably gives it a bit of a bump. But yeah, I mean, considering that the franchise was dead in 2004, with no movies in pre-production and no show on the air, and then, you know, the Vegas experience being torn down a few years later, like, it was nice to see that they were at least trying to do something, and what we got, I thought, was pretty solid.
Well, and arguably part of the reason why we're even sitting here doing this is because of that film. If it weren't, it had not been for that film, then I doubt we would be seeing this resurgence in Trek that we've seen in the last few years. And with Discovery and all these new shows coming out, I mean, this podcast started kind of in anticipation of Discovery. And so there's a good chance we may not be here having this conversation. Well, we definitely wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation because this movie wouldn't have existed. But the point being, I mean, love it or hate it, and there are a lot of hardcore Star Trek fans that really hate this film and hate on the JJ verse and call him Jar Jar Abrams. And there's just a lot of negativity and very non-Trek attitudes out there. But I think that this definitely, it brought new fans into the fold, who a lot of which went back and watched a lot, or if not all of the old stuff. So
I think there are just some definite golden moments that are true Trek in these films. And yes, they are more action. Yes, they are more emotional. And that's fine. That's what happens when new people come into things.
Yes.
And I still believe that it is deeply rooted in Trek, and that Abrams and Lynn went into this with as much love for the original as they possibly could. You know, it's not necessarily Abrams' fault that he wasn't into this, but he did his homework and he respected what came before. And, you know, you can see good moments in this that is truly Trek.
Absolutely.
Fair enough. I think that's a good spot to end on. So
yeah, I'm good like that.
Next week, we will be discussing Star Trek Into Darkness, which is the second Kelvin timeline film.
Almost universally hated.
And the 12th Star Trek movie. So we'll be discussing that one next week. So go ahead and rewatch that if you're joining us. Ray, how can people find you?
I am at Siren Ray. I am a cosplayer. I am a podcaster. I trash talk, and you know, you can find me locally at, you know, most donut or pizza shops. You're likely to bump into me there, so that's cool.
Zach,
I am at AvengersES on Twitter and Instagram. Those are the best ways to find me. I'm, you know, talking Trek, my cat. Politics, you know, the important stuff in life.
Talking Trek with your cat, or
you know what? I live by myself, so
that's a podcast.
That's a podcast. Yes,
I think it's just called monologuing.
Trekking cats.
Yes.
And I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter, of course. You can come talk to me. I'm out there every day for that. And you can also find Ray and I on Screen Heroes, our TV and movie podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. Please follow us at RedShirtsPod on Twitter. We're doing polls every week for these movies and things like that. You can come talk to us out there or find us at heroespodcasts.com or at heroespodcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We will catch you next time.
See ya.
Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. The show is hosted by myself, Gregory Bosco, along with Jeremy Munkin and Derek Mayer. The theme song is by Flying Killer Robots. You can find us, as well as other Heroes Podcast Network shows, at heroespodcast.com, as well as on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, and anywhere you can use an RSS feed. Follow us on social media at Heroes Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitch. And you can also email us at contact@heroespodcast.com. Engage.